This is Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. I'm your host, Maureen Metcalf, founder and CEO of the Innovative Leadership Institute, where we help leaders be future ready. Helping us in this mission today is Michael Marks, a technology investor and operating executive for nearly 40 years. We'll be talking about his leadership and management lessons from his storied career. So, Michael, thank you so much for being here and welcome.
My pleasure, Maureen. Thanks for having me.
President Trump has just rolled back some of the tariffs. Others are continuing. So let's talk about, if you were back as the CEO of Tesla, what would you want them to be thinking about and doing right now?
It's a very complicated question. And the good news or bad news is that the answer I'm going to give you is a timeless answer. It's not depending on what's going on today. And it goes like this. Everybody underestimates how interconnected the global supply chains are. So when people talk about separating supply chains, I can tell you unequivocally that that is impossible. And I'm going to give you an example. What you see in the news is people talk about what are the tariffs going to be like on shoes that are all manufactured in China, Apple phones that are manufactured in China. What everybody underestimates is how complex these supply chains are. And if you go back to, for example, before World War II or during World War II, everybody separated the supply chains. You could do that. It is impossible today. Let me give you an example. And I used to teach this at Stanford Business School. This was one of the examples I used some years back, which is that there was an earthquake in the north part of Japan. I don't know, this is 15 years ago or whatever. And, you know, it took out some factories and stuff like that. What happened was 90 days later, there were no red cars on any dealership lots in the world. And that's because there was a factory in this little town that nobody even knew of that made a chemical that went into auto paint to make the pigment red. And it turns out it was the only supplier in the world. Nobody even knew that. They probably didn't know it themselves. That's the issue that we're facing. So you can talk about what parts go into a phone. But you have to look at what goes into those parts. What are the chemicals? What are the materials? What are the rare earth minerals? And it is literally impossible to map a supply chain like that. So we're having all this conversation at a high level, and it is literally impossible. It's impossible for China to separate from us. It's impossible for us to separate from China, and so on. So when I listen to all this stuff about tariffs, I'm not saying there's no value to the concepts or whatever. I'm not going to wade into the politics of it. But what I am saying is if we have a global tariff war, a trade war, it will still be impossible to separate the supply chains. And we will only see those things roll out over time. It's just too complex to map.
35 years ago, I worked for Unisys and the Buy American Act was in place then, and I was in a contracts role, and we were supposed to designate which were Buy American products. And we really had to go back to where do you count the process? Is it manufactured? Is it assembled? Which parts go back and forth 5 or 6 times across borders? So where did they originate? And to your point, it becomes an exercise that doesn't have much value.
Well, look, Maureen, you can see it in autos right now. I mean, people can't figure out what's going on in an auto, how much content is from the United States and how much is, like you just pointed out, is shipped back and forth across borders. These things are really complex and they do not lend themselves to the simple kind of political statements.
One of my clients runs a chemical company. They're in the US, but also UK, Singapore, and India. How do you even navigate something that is this uncertain?
I don't have a good answer. It's just not possible. No good answers.
Looking for the silver bullets.
Yeah, good luck.
So if you were running one of these companies and there is no good answer, what do you do?
I don't really know. There's not a simple answer to that. It depends on what kinds of companies. It depends on what the alternatives are. I can tell you that it takes 10 years to build an auto plant in the United States. So it's not like all of a sudden everybody's going to go, hey, I have an idea. Let's just go build a plant down the street. One of the statistics that I am very familiar with and like to talk about is that in the United States today, there are 600,000 unfilled manufacturing jobs. 600,000 unfilled manufacturing jobs today, and half of those are unskilled. Where's the labor going to come from for all this bring back manufacturing in the United States. We can't even fill the jobs we have now. It's ridiculous.
And the new plants are going to be more technologically advanced. And frankly, by the time they get here, we'll be in a different political administration.
Right. So nobody's going to make the decisions to make tens of billions of dollars of investments in the United States under this environment. We're just going to be a lot of noise for a long time. Too bad.
We've just talked about supply chain. It seems appropriate then to raise the question of innovation, that in some ways we will innovate out of the challenges we have or innovate forward to reduce some of them. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your point of view on innovation versus execution?
I get asked this question a lot. You know, they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, you have to have both. I do find an awful lot of question like, okay, how much do I spend, for example, today everybody's talking about artificial intelligence. How much do I use AI in the things that we're doing versus not? And of course, everybody's trying to figure it out. Companies that don't innovate die. It's only a matter of time. All you have to do is look around. Look at the stocks, the Nifty 50 from 50, 60 years ago. You know, there's like three of them left on the top companies on Wall Street. It's because companies, if they don't change, they die. One of the saddest examples is what's happened to Intel, you know, one of the most powerful companies, you know, of a generation ago. And they didn't innovate. They focused on execution. They focused on their customers. They focused on all the things that it seems like are the right things to do. But what happened was people innovated around them, AMD and NVIDIA and DeepSeek and all these different changes to the world. The good news is my partner, Lip-Bu Tan, is now the CEO there, and he understands these things and hopefully can right the ship. But that's an example of a company, and there are many, many companies. Look at retail. Look what happened when Amazon came in, and you could get on your telephone or on your computer, and you could have a delivery done the next day. I mean, Amazon changed the whole retail landscape, right? And now they're changing it again by deliveries. I mean, I'm amazed by this. You can get on your computer or your phone 3 o'clock in the afternoon and order something, and it's on your doorstep first thing in the morning the next day. And now the people who haven't done that are having to really work to catch up, and the good ones are catching up, but a lot of them are falling by the wayside. All companies have to execute. If you don't execute, you also die, but that's obvious, right? And so when people talk about do you execute or you innovate, execute is table stakes. Innovation is what's required to change your business and stay modern and stay focused. And there's always changes. Right now, it's AI, but there was .com and there was software as a service. And you name these innovations and they become ubiquitous in the landscape. And if you're not adapting to them, adopting them, you're getting in trouble for sure.
We both agree that AI is significant. Do you have any thoughts on how, again, leaders proceed? We hear scope, it's going to be the biggest change of our careers. I talk about it like a large change management experience. We have to implement and transform our organization smartly, depending on where we are in the hype cycle and how it supports our business. How do we go forward looking at and scoping our AI investments?
Well, look, it's the subject of the day and everybody's talking about it. You use the right word when you say, where are we in the hype cycle? Because we are way in the hype cycle. Clearly, AI is going to change the way we work. It's going to change the landscape. But there is so much hype. And I'm going to give you a perfect example, and that is drug development. There are so many companies out raising money. AI can develop drugs. And the reality is AI can't develop drugs. One of our companies, Prelis, the CEO, knows quite a bit about this. We did our own podcast on the subject. And what he always says is, if AI can develop drugs, where are they? And there's not one drug out there that has been developed by AI. The reality is, you have to start with a molecule. You can improve it, but you can't create it from scratch. A really good example of this is the concept that you can train AI to speak English and to make sentences and to write articles and all that kind of stuff. You cannot have AI invent the Russian language if it doesn't have samples to work from. I'll give you another really good example. Just read an article recently about Apple and Google and Amazon announced big AI upgrades to their products, to Alexa, to their phones. And guess what? They haven't done it yet. They're already a year behind. And so your listeners and everybody in the world needs to take a deep breath and think that AI matters. It's important. You should learn about it. You should try it. You should find uses for it in your businesses and in your daily life. But let's not lose sight of the fact that these things evolve over a much longer period of time than the hype machine would suggest. And the hype machine is based on people creating value so that they can get investors. The reason, you know, Amazon talks about upgrading Alexa is because they don't want people to not use Alexa. So you can understand these things. But these changes take more time than people would have you believe.
For the companies you're investing in, what do you want to ensure that they're attending to in the AI space?
Well, it's different for different companies, of course, because we have many companies that are actually in the AI space. For example, one of my favorites, White Rabbit, which is using artificial intelligence to read mammograms. This company's AI is 8 years in the making. It wasn't just invented last year with Llama and these things. We have many companies. We have another company, Percipient, which is using AI to analyze images from drones and satellites and cameras to find the bad guys. Also 8 years in the making. Artificial intelligence is not new. And so for many of our companies, they are just using the new tools to create new products, and that's valuable. In terms of day-to-day management, you know, you can use AI now to make your plane reservations. So go do that. I mean, go be efficient. You can use AI to do a lot of back office tools. And these are very simple and straightforward, and you should use them. It's like back when the PC was invented, you wanted to use it because here's a new tool and this is a new tool. So we have to find ways to use it.
You've had a very successful career. You've been CEO. You've been in the VC space and you teach at Stanford. What differentiates you? If you think back to you're fresh out of college, you're surrounded by other young men fresh out of college. What made you different than those other young men and women that were your peers?
I'll answer that in a slightly different way than the way you asked it. And I'll answer it in the way of what I think makes for the most successful executives. And I'm clear on this subject, and that is curiosity. I happen to be very curious, and I have lots of people that I work with and I'm around who are very curious. What matters about curiosity, it goes back to your question about innovation and how you use new tools. People who are curious are always looking around. What is that? What is that over there? Gosh, I didn't realize that there was something that I could do with AI, for example, or reading the newspaper. And today it's not the newspaper, but it's online, but it doesn't matter. I tell the students, when I was a student at Harvard Business School back in the 70s, one of my professors the first day of school said, you're in business school now, you need to get a subscription to the Wall Street Journal. And I did, and I still read it as much as I can every day for 40 years. Now I tell my students the same thing. If you are not curious, you're not paying attention to what's around you, how will you adapt? How will you react to competition? How will you come up with a new idea that somebody else isn't using that will allow you to make your company bigger and more advanced? So I was lucky. I think I was born curious. And I don't think that's something you just decide about. But I ran a global company and I was always reading what's going on in Brazil, what's going on in Europe. Why are they doing things differently from the way we do it? And if I hadn't been able to do that and adapt to all this new information, I would never have been able to manage Flextronics into the size of a company that we became.
Some of our listeners probably don't know the Flextronics story. Give us a little bit of insight into what you grew it from and what were your biggest enablers.
Sure. In fact, it touches on all these things we've already talked about, so I'd be happy to do that. So I had worked at Flextronics in 1990. It was not a very well-run company for a variety of reasons. I left and went on to do some other things. The company got in financial trouble and shut down their U.S. operations and had just an Asian operation. And the banks decided to pull the plug and wanted to raise $8.5 million, which is what they were owed. So I put together a group of investors, and I was fortunate to have met them along the way, Sequoia Capital and Kiner Perkins and NEA, the major venture firms in this area. And we put $8.5 million together and bought 55% of the company. So it was a $15 million valuation in 1993. So we had $90 million of revenue. We were profitable. Little company, only factories in Hong Kong, Singapore, and in a little town in China. And over the next 13 years, my management team and I built it into a $25 billion company with 300,000 employees, factories in 26 countries, and 15,000 suppliers. We're obviously proud of that. When I started, we were 22nd in the industry by revenue. And when I retired at the age of 55, by the way, we were number two. So we went from 22 to two. Those other companies mostly survived. We acquired a couple of them. But when I started, it was a cheap hands business. That's in quotes, cheap hands. And what that means is that people outsource labor. Hewlett-Packard would have a little assembly facility down the street because there was lower cost labor, less sophisticated labor than they were used to. When I left, we designed their products, we manufactured them, we handled the logistics, we took their orders. We would take the orders, build them, ship them to the customer, and then tell Hewlett-Packard that we'd just shipped a product and they owed us money for it. It became a very sophisticated business. And we did that by having our eyes open to, okay, what are the customers doing? What can we do better for the customers? Right now, all we do is do labor. We're cheap hands. That's not an interesting business. That's not exciting or higher margin. What if we started buying the materials? And then we started buying the materials. What if we started to design the products? What if we warehoused the products for them? What if we did everything for them? And as we did that and bigger, we got better at that than any of our customers. And today, almost nobody does their own manufacturing. Like everything's outsourced. But when I started, everybody had their own factories. And so what we did was we said, let's get better at it than them. You asked the question about execution. We out-executed them because it's what mattered to us every day, whereas they had customers and products and marketing and branding and distribution, blah, blah. We didn't have any of that. So we out-executed them. But we also out-innovated them. So not only did we execute, but we went and said, how can we do this better? What tools can we find? One of the things, for example, we did, one of my proudest moments was the day we launched a new Xbox, the Microsoft Xbox. We launched it in three continents on the same day, North America, Asia, and Europe. And we had factories, so we had to set up the manufacturing and the supply chains and all of that. And on the same day, we launched the production of a product around the world. That was innovative. That was not something that anybody had ever done on their own. So combination of execution, combination of innovation, and we had a fantastic culture. We were able to develop a system where everybody just loved working at the company and wanted to come to work every day and make things just a little bit better. So that was a real ride.
How did you build that culture? Because we often hear that culture is the secret sauce.
Well, I can speak to this, I think, pretty well, and I hope your audience will get a kick out of some of the things that I have to say. First of all, there are many different kinds of cultures. In my experience, different cultures work. So long as everybody in the business buys into that culture. So let me give you an example. One culture, which was ours at Flextronics, is where the CEO wants to be surrounded by other people who know more than the CEO knows, and you give them the rope to go run their part of the business. And then they hire other people, and they hire people like that. And as long as everybody fits that, the culture works great. Now, I've also seen the exact opposite work incredibly well, which is where the CEO likes to tell everybody what to do. And that works equally well as long as that person is surrounded by people who want to be told what to do. You have to have internally consistent cultures, but they can be very different. Where people fail in creating cultures is that they don't weed out the people who don't fit. And when companies get big, it's really hard to keep a culture intact. One of the techniques I used at Flextronics was I wrote a little blurb irregularly. I wrote it. People used to always ask if somebody wrote them for me, but I wrote them. And it was called The View From Here. By the way, not The View From The Top, The View From Here. And then I would write about things that I had seen. Like I'd go off to visit our factory in Hungary and I would see something that they had done that I wanted to acknowledge and want everybody to think about it in their own businesses. So I'd write a view from here saying, I just came from this factory in Hungary and there was a problem with logistics. And the guys rented a plane to go get the parts to bring it in. This is a true story. To make sure that the customer got their product on time. And I published that in every language. And eventually I started doing video views from here so that I could tell what was happening in the public markets, how people reacted to our quarterly statements. And we translated that into all the languages that people were. So everybody was hearing a consistent story about the company, what we thought was important. Now I'll give you a cute little story because it's one of the things that happens when companies get big and you can't manage them very well. And one of the things that happens is, in a big company, if you fire somebody, it's not uncommon for them to show up someplace else in the business, right? Because somebody goes, oh, you lost your job. I have a job over here. And so they do that. So I once was talking to Howard Stringer, who is the CEO of Sony. And this is one of my favorite stories, and I've told it a lot of times because humor works extremely well in getting messages across. And I said, so how's it been like running Sony? He goes, you're telling me how bureaucratic it was. This is many, many years ago. So this is not a statement about how Sony is today. But he said, I fired the guy who was running Canada. And then 6 months later, I was in India and the guy was running India. And I said, so did you fire him again? And he said, no, I was afraid he'd show up someplace he could hurt me. I love that story. Anyhow, cultures are difficult to manage, especially as companies get large.
Did you have a specific goal for your culture?
The View From Here was just a way of communicating. I mean, there were 300,000 people in 26 countries. I wanted everybody to know what I thought was important in the company. That was just one technique. There are many techniques. You have various meetings that you hold and all this kind of stuff. But that was one easy way of everybody in the company hearing from me about the things that I thought was important so I could reinforce parts of the culture that I wanted. That's one technique among many. But I will say that because in our company, the culture was to go figure out how to make things happen and not wait to be told what to do, when we would hire people who wanted to be told what to do, they would wander around going, what am I supposed to do? And people would tell them, you're supposed to figure out what you're supposed to do. And ultimately, we had a company across town in the Bay Area where it came from a company where everybody was told what to do. And I had to put out an edict no longer to ever hire anybody from that company because it was obvious they just couldn't fit into our culture. So look, it's lots of tricks, Maureen, lots of techniques and tricks, and people have different ones. Mine isn't the only way to be successful, but that's how I did it.
There are probably some consistent themes, whether you choose to be an empowering leader or a directive leader. The building blocks underneath are likely similar.
That's right. There's an old saying I like to say is that nines hire tens and sevens hire sixes. I always wanted to get rid of the sevens and hire nines or tens.
So what was one of your biggest challenges? Hopefully you didn't fire anyone from one region and have them show up in another.
Oh, I'm sure it happened, but
Not that you know of.
Not that I know of.
So how do I continually evolve? What does that look like for you? And what was one of your more interesting learning opportunities?
Look, I evolve like everybody else. There's new experiences, new tools. I still am very curious. I'm always trying to learn about things. Right now, I'm doing a lot of investing in the biomedical space, which is something I don't know much about, but I'm fascinated by it. And I'm always asking questions. How does this work? How does that work? So that's just an interesting thing. One of the things that appears to have separated me from a lot of people is that I'm very transparent and very truthful. And what I mean by that is I tell people what I think. I'm not afraid of rejection. I like ideas. I like a good interchange of ideas. And I'll always say what I think, but I'm always prepared to change my mind if I hear something that's better than mine. And apparently that's a rarer trait than I imagined because it's mine. So I don't know. It seems like, why doesn't everybody do that? But I always had people coming back and saying, I came to hear you because I know you'll tell me the truth and most people won't, especially in the investing business, by the way. In the investing business, nobody wants to say, I don't like the idea because they're afraid that it might turn out to be successful and they might be interested in the future. So they say, we don't have any money, or people make a bunch of excuses. And I say, look, I don't like the idea. Here's why. But you asked a question about a tough situation I was in, and I had one, maybe one of the toughest I can remember, but we were a public company, and it was in 2000. And if 2000, March, April of 2000 is when NASDAQ hit its peak, and it dropped 80%, and our stock dropped from 24 to 2, and it was a very tough time in the business. We had a customer who was a big customer, who shall remain nameless, but a big publicly traded company. When I talked earlier, Maureen, one of the things we did for our customers is we monitored and oftentimes took their orders directly. And this company had given us big volume orders for the quarter. It was obvious that the orders weren't coming in. And so at the end of the first month of the quarter, I went to the senior VP of operations and said, you need to reduce your orders because your orders are not coming in. And his response was, we're not cutting our orders. We always make our numbers. It's oftentimes back-end loaded in the quarter, which is true, but we're not going to cut our orders. At the end of the second month, it was even worse, and I went in to that same executive and said, look, I can see that the orders are not coming in. We have to reduce these orders, or we're going to have a real problem. And he said, same answer, stick with the orders we've given you. And at the end of the quarter, they missed horribly. And we were stuck with hundreds of millions of dollars of inventory. And I went to him and said, you have to pay us. We're not in the business of holding this kind of inventory. And his response was, no, you have to eat this. We're partners, quote unquote. We're partners, and we expect you to eat these costs. Meanwhile, we're a public company. And I said, that's unconscionable. I actually told you in advance twice to cut your orders, and you didn't. And now you expect me to hold on to it, and we're not going to. And he said, if you don't, we will pull all of our business from you. And this was $800 million of business. Okay, so now I'm in a crack. Yeah, obviously talked to my board about it. Called around other companies to see if this customer was treating them the same way, which they were. And in the end, I said, pay us. And they paid us. And they took away all of our business. We're a public company. And I went to Wall Street in our public announcement, told them what happened very clearly. And I said, we have to stand for something. We don't have the kind of margins where our customers can put us in this position. So we're going to miss our numbers pretty badly. And I got asked about this every quarterly earnings for about 3 years, which is how long it took us to get out of it. And I've never been sorry for a day. I think I took the exact right position. I think they were unconscionable. They were a bully. And I just said no. And then I wrote it into a case for Stanford Business School.
Does the case give the company name?
Not in the case.
No.
I actually used three. It's actually a case I wrote on business ethics. And I used three companies. They were all major companies. We didn't name them in the case, but when I teach it, I say who the companies were. Yeah.
You just talked about bullying. It's an interesting time where we are seeing more bullying.
Yes.
That's causing companies to face significant financial challenges right now, like you're talking about, where you may lose significant revenue and potentially go out of business.
That's right. It's terrible, Maureen. Look, I sympathize with all the companies who go through what they're going through now or at any periods of time, where there are geopolitical issues or there are financial issues. Look, our stock at Flextronics went from $24 to $2. We were afraid we were going out of business. This was in the summer of 2000. We survived it, but companies go out of business. And when they do, I hope that the people learn their lessons and rise again in some other business, which happens very frequently. Often they do, especially here in Silicon Valley. If you don't have a couple of failures on your resume, you're probably not that good.
It also doesn't feel good when it's happening.
No, it doesn't.
What do you want our listeners to walk away with? You're working with people from Stanford Business School all the way through large-scale CEOs. You've talked about curiosity. You've talked about balancing innovation and execution. Is there a thing that you really want to encourage people at this point in history?
Yes, thank you for that. That's a big opportunity for me. I will say the following, and I'm a technology investor as an operating executive, but I've been investing now for the last 20 years. It's a real joy to be invested, particularly in early stage companies, because there's just so much excitement. Let's just take a little trip down memory lane of the venture capital industry. It started in the 70s and 80s, just in a small group of companies from Silicon. It's called Silicon Valley for a reason. It started with Fairchild and National Semiconductor, and then Intel was created. And here's this group of hardware investors up and down the valley here. And look at the revolutions that came from that, from PCs to networks to workstations to cell phones to memory changes, storage, all these things. Fantastic stuff. But pretty narrow, if you think about it, as a kind of technology. Well, then everybody went off for the last 20 years and we only do software. Everybody overpaid for the same deals and all that stuff. And we could get into why everybody just wanted to do software. They thought it was more capital efficient, which it is not. But then something dramatic happened, and that is NVIDIA became the most powerful company, the most valuable company, and one of the most powerful companies in the world. My friend Jensen Huang and my friend Hock Tan at Broadcom and Qualcomm, and all of a sudden people are looking at their portfolios going, we don't have any hardware in here. And so all of a sudden we became the cool kids again because we've just been doing hardware all this time. We do some AI stuff as we talked about. But the broader point is this. Right now, technology is everywhere. This is the most exciting time in the history of the world to be an entrepreneur because you don't have to be somebody who knows about semiconductors. You don't have to be somebody who knows about software. Now you have this explosion in the medical world, all these new medical diagnostics, like using artificial intelligence to read mammograms or creating a handheld molecular sensing device to allow you to pick up avian flu, which is one of our companies, Alveo. You have all kinds of things happening in the medical arena. You have all kinds of innovation in the way services are delivered much more efficiently. We just talked about getting packages delivered to your front door in less than 24 hours. You have incredible evolutions in the way people share their homes, the way they share their cars. So you have financial services. Now you have buy now, pay later. Everywhere you look, there are innovative things happening. And so if I were giving any advice to the entrepreneurs out there, if I'm giving advice to the entrepreneurs, no better time in history to be an entrepreneur than today. If I'm giving advice to investors, like no better time in the history of the world to be an investor in technology and innovation. It's like, how can we not go to work every day with a giant smile on their face, which is what happens to me every single day?
Thank you so much. I'm going to summarize some of what I heard, and I'm going to start with ethics. Your example of, I think your wording was, if you don't stand for something, you don't stand for anything. The example you gave was so palpable that you were willing to face Wall Street, potentially lose your job, and potentially have a significantly adverse impact on stock and the company's future. We all can talk about ethics, but again, until you take a stand for something, it's just words. Second was balancing innovation and execution. Again, lots of people have good ideas. Everyone wants to write a book or do a thing, but the number of people who actually execute effectively is significantly smaller, and the ability to both innovate and execute concurrently and consistently is also kind of the secret sauce. And then the third one was the idea of curiosity. And I love the point that I'm curious, I ask questions, and when someone comes up with better ideas, I change my point of view. If you're curious and learning, you're changing. Especially now, you can't live in this time without evolving your point of view.
That's right.
And that allows your company to evolve and thrive.
And look, there's conflicting points of view all the time. That's what makes life interesting.
It is also what differentiates us and our organizations. The courage to say, that's what we thought yesterday, and we've learned something new today.
That's right.
Thank you so much. How would people learn about you, Michael? Follow your blogs or whatever you are publishing?
Thanks for asking that. Our firm is Celesta. You can reach me at Marks, M-A-R-K-S, at celesta.vc. I answer all of my emails. We have a deep tech podcast, which is very highly rated, which I'm very pleased about. It's called Tech Surge. We cover lots of different topics, some fascinating stuff. So that's another place you can learn about us.
Thank you so much, Michael. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today on Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future.
Do you love amazing stories? I know I do. I'm Michael Kent, and every week on my show, we examine something from history that's so unbelievable it sounds made up, but is 100% verifiably true. It's a podcast called The Internet Says It's True, and there are hundreds of episodes to choose from. For example, did you know the story of how Leonard Nimoy came up with Live Long and Prosper for Star Trek? Or how Colombia is dealing with a hippo problem that goes back directly to Pablo Escobar? Or one of my favorite stories, a man figured out that a nondescript Winnebago being auctioned online was actually an important part of space exploration history. These are all stories from The Internet Says It's True. Listening to a podcast has never been easier. You can listen through any popular podcast app, through the NPR app, or download the fantastic new WCBE app, click the Podcasts tab, and look for The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent. You'll have so many stories up your sleeve, you'll feel like the smartest person in the room, especially if you're home alone.
It is said every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hey there, music lovers. Tano Jones here of the Tano Jones Revelry. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, or perhaps what music means to them, and so much more. Music Journeys airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, Tano Jones, look for Music Journeys in WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org. You guys be well. Peace.